tell you a lot of people at the Irving Yogi, would that be right? Or? What's that? Okay. For those who are here, perhaps you can mention to those who are not here that they should listen to this class, because we're actually doing a summary of about the last three classes, so it's probably the most important class out of all of them. So it's probably the worst one to miss. Because what we've actually done is we've looked at, you know, different concepts, starting, of course, with Arjuna's reasons why he should not fight. And there were four principal reasons based on Arjuna's so-called compassion or misdirected compassion, his fear of not being able to enjoy the results of his activities, fear of incurring sinful reaction, and fear of destruction of the dynasty and thus the loss of Vedic culture. So, and of course, Arjuna was also suffering from indecision, which was really mitigated when he actually accepted Krishna as his spiritual master. That really dissolved that problem of indecision. So, Krishna began giving, first of all, of course, he explained to Arjuna in verse 11. So we're going from about verse 11 to verse 37. That's what we're discussing. That's a summary. Some very important points. We've had a few different thinking exercises, and the good thing there is it reveals to all of us individually and myself what we know and where there's some confusion, and therefore, as you know, it also reveals to us that when we begin to, you know, we're reading through the Bhagavad Gita, but when we begin to apply it practically, any limitations in our thought process or in our understanding are immediately revealed. So now what we want to do is to look at that, where the confusions were, you know, any lack of understanding, where there was some understanding, and consolidate that, and just make sure that before we move on through the Bhagavad Gita, that we all have a good grounded understanding of what we've covered so far. So, Krishna, first of all, chastised Arjuna for speaking so-called words of wisdom, which were actually foolish because they were directed towards the bodily concept of life. Then from verse 12, Krishna begins to explain to Arjuna, you know, using Sankhya, which is a method of bringing about the truth of the situation, of the actuality, the truth of reality, to reveal the spiritual nature of the soul, which is a consideration that Arjuna wasn't taking into account. So therefore, in doing that, Krishna made his assertion in verse 12 that all living entities, including himself, are eternally individual, eternally individual souls. That was his statement. And throughout, you know, right up to verse 30, Krishna really confirmed that with and explained it in further detail and gave various analogies and examples to really bring home that essential truth that he stated there. And in verses 12 and 13, Srila Prabhupada gives four strong arguments that completely defeat the Mayavadi proposition that individuality is only on the material platform and not on the spiritual platform. That is what the Mayavadis think. They think that there is no individual souls. Individuality exists only in the material world, and therefore it is an illusion. It is not the eternal reality, it is a temporary illusion. That is their philosophy. So, Srila Prabhupada, in text 12 and 13, the text and in his purports, he gives four arguments which totally defeat that Mayavadi proposition. And those same arguments are really just reconfirmed as we go through those further texts elucidating the nature of the soul, right up to text number 30. So what are those four arguments? So the first proposition is that now we did write these down, but we can write them down again at some stage if you need to, if you remind me at some stage. Krishna's first proposition is that we are all eternally individuals. And the Mayavadi argument is that, no, that is not correct. On the spiritual platform, we're all one. There's no individuality, and individuality exists only in the material world. So the argument to counter that is that if Krishna is therefore thinking, oh, I am an individual, and the Mayavadis would say, well then, that is illusion. That means the Bhagavad Gita loses its authority because Krishna is speaking from a platform of illusion. And therefore the Mayavadis, who do, accept the Bhagavad Gita, some do, some don't, they can't argue on the basis of Bhagavad Gita anymore because they've just confirmed that it's spoken by someone who's in illusion. Right. So that's the first point. Does everyone understand that? Is there any doubt? Yeah? I'll just answer that question as well.
My pen's not working.
Okay, do you want another one? So. Yeah.
So, a quick question.
Yeah.
What is the difference between Sankhya and Jnana?
Okay. Sankhya is the process by which Jnana, knowledge, is revealed. Jnana is the result of Sankhya.
Okay.
Sankhya is analyzing what is, there, and the result of that analysis, when it is done properly, precipitates knowledge down.
Okay.
So, so we're going to repeat that again, right? So, all of it, or the how the argument
is.
Yes. So, Krishna says, individuality is eternal. That God and the living entities are all eternally living, eternally individual. The Mayavadis say, no, that is illusion. If that is the case, then Krishna thinking he is an individual and thinking others are individual he is an illusion. If he is an illusion, his Bhagavad Gita is a fiction. If Bhagavad Gita is a fiction, why should anyone accept it? or use it as a basis of authority, right? So therefore, you know, it's contradictory from their point, only from the Mayavadi's point. From the devotional point, they accept that Krishna is not an illusion, and that's the truth. So if someone doesn't accept that, then they're saying you're an illusion. And they say, you're an illusion because you state this in the Bhagavad Gita. But how can they quote the Bhagavad Gita, which they think is a book written by someone in illusion, which is fictitious? Right. So, does everyone understand that point?
Can we say that those who are Gyan Margi, they are not Bhakti Margi but Gyan Margi, can we consider them as Krishna's devotee? Because in Srimad Bhagavad-gita, Krishna said that the outcome of both of them is one, and that's me, nothing else, not different. So if that's the case, the outcome of Gyan Marga and Bhakti Marga is one, can we consider them as Krishna's devotee?
If there is some, to the degree that there's some bhakti in that Gyan, you can accept to that degree that they're a devotee, and to the degree that bhakti is lacking, to that degree, then not accepted as a devotee. Gyan without bhakti cannot be accepted as Krishna's devotee. Yeah?
Mayavadi is common argument is they used to say, now you not realize, after practicing Jnana Marga you can realize what Krishna realized.
Yes, right?
This is one of the arguments of Mayavadi.
Right, so what he's saying is that Mayavadi say that we are not realized, but when you become realized from unrealized, you'll realize what Krishna realized. And of course what they say Krishna realized is that I am Brahman. Right? So so Prabhupada's argument there counters that Mayavadi philosophy. But then the Mayavadis, they will say, in order to avoid being caught like that, they will then say that, oh, when Krishna is speaking of individuality in verse 12, he's speaking with reference to the material platform of life. Therefore, Krishna is not an illusion, as you're pointing out, that he's actually realized in Brahman. Right? And in this way they counter that argument. Right? So we say, they say, Krishna, that's right, alright, we can't have Krishna being an illusion because we're accepting Bhagavad Gita, so therefore Krishna is speaking of individuality on a material platform, but actually you know, he is not an illusion. Alright? So, in this way they're saying, Krishna is not accepting that he is an eternal individual, or that others are eternally individual. He's saying that that only exists on material platform. So therefore, that seems to be confirming what the Mayavadis say. Alright? But that would be a good argument if it were true. But the fact is, as pointed out, as Prabhupada counters, Krishna has just chastised Arjuna for thinking in those terms. You know, that considering things from the material platform. So then, you know, why would Krishna then go back to speaking in those terms like a fool himself? Right? You understand that? So,
what if the Kandas are saying that Krishna is not an illusion, but In our present state of realization, we are an illusion.
Yes.
There are different stages of reality.
Yes.
In this stage of reality, we perceive Krishna as saying this.
Mm-hmm.
But on another stage of reality, what we actually understand is this.
Yeah, in a sense, that's what they do say. Which brings us to our next, the third point, which is really the crucial arguments against the Mayavadis. There are four points here. This is the third. And this point, as I mentioned last week, is actually referred to by the, in the VTE, as verse 23. Because there it says that the soul cannot be cut. And that piece of information is crucial. So far there's been a little discussion, you know, as to really what Krishna means. But this statement, of course, is confirmed by other Vedic statements that the soul, Brahman, cannot be cut. Therefore, if the Mayavadis say, okay, Krishna is not an illusion, but he's saying that all those others, you know, Krishna, I'm Brahman, realize. I realize that I am the Supreme Brahman. But all the others are an illusion. So we have to ask the question, if Brahman can't be cut, how can there be others? Alright? Number one. They either eternally exist as fragmental, eternal, atomic individuals, spiritual individuals, or they don't. So the Mayavadi is saying, well, okay, Krishna, he is speaking about the Supreme Brahman. We'll accept that he is Brahman realized, but they are an illusion. So, you know, but that verse 23, defeats that because, you know, the Brahman, which Krishna is supposed to represent, can't be cut into all these other little fragments. And as Prabhupada quite often points out, nor can they explain how the Supreme Brahman actually becomes, which is, Supreme Brahman means, you know, full consciousness. Full consciousness means no illusion. How can full consciousness be covered by ignorance, illusion, you know, different states of ignorance, lack of consciousness? But they cannot actually explain that. So, that's a crucial element in understanding. If they accept that there is a Supreme Brahman who perhaps manifests in this world as such a personality as Krishna, the Brahman is within Krishna, and that he is Brahman realized, he is above illusion, even if they admit that, they cannot explain that if he is Brahman, and Brahman can't be cut into these little pieces, how come there are so many different individual fragments of Brahman that somehow have been disconnected from the Supreme Brahman and covered by ignorance, because that doesn't confirm any Vedic statement about Brahman. Is that clear?
To that, the Mayavad could potentially reply that actually everything is one, nothing is being cut from anything, mm-hmm. neither is anything fragmented from anything. Mm-hmm. It is just that by inconceivably you have different you have different states of consciousness, and when these states of consciousness are elevated, then they actually realize that nothing has been cut, nothing has been broken away. Do you understand? Mm-hmm.
What has different states of consciousness?
parts of Brahman.
Parts of Brahman. But even the minor bodies accept that Brahman can't be cut. It is one, indivisible. That is the very definition of Brahman. So either you're talking about something else, if we have to stay on the topic. If we're talking about Brahman, we're talking about the one undistinguished, you know, indivisible spiritual effulgence. So I have to ask you, who is having these different levels of consciousness? You're saying that, you know, there are other parts of Brahman, that, you know, but Brahman doesn't have other parts. It's indistinguishable. So therefore, you know, the Vedic statements in Krishna's Bhagavad Gita is saying, there are, you know, if you accept that there are other parts, then you're accepting the statements of the Vedas, but those other parts are eternally other parts. Because it can't be cut, and therefore the Mayavadis really, you know, they have to admit, oh, there does seem to be other parts of Brahman. Okay, if there are other parts, then they must be eternal other parts, eternally fragmented. Because Brahman can't be cut. So you're really confirming Krishna's statement.
Does the argument I presented confirm, because it is said that Mayavads understand that the living entity is pure consciousness, but according to Vaishnava philosophy, consciousness is a symptom of the living entity. The argument I just stated, I think, would it be the essence of Mayavad philosophy? In the sense that you have different levels of consciousness. Mm-hmm. And when these levels of consciousness don't exist separately, they're just consciousness. And when this consciousness becomes elevated, then it's just one. So is this where the Mayavad theory comes? Where they say that living entity is pure consciousness? Based on the level of awareness.
Well, I had to ask you, who has these different levels of consciousness?
I've got a different question. I accept what you're saying. But in terms of the Mayavad conclusion of the living entity is pure consciousness, this is where it comes from. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because according to your level of consciousness, according to the Mayavads, you can perceive oneness and you can perceive difference. If you are just consciousness, if you elevate your consciousness, then you are on the Brahman realization. If you lower your consciousness, then you are on the individual realization.
Yeah.
So in that sense, you're pure consciousness. Mm. Is that where the Mayavad argument comes from? That the living entity is just...
The living entity is pure consciousness. That, they do say that. The living entity is pure consciousness, yes.
And this is where this argument comes from.
Well, they're saying the living entity, there is really one living entity who is pure consciousness. And because there is no other living entity, that one living entity really can't even consider itself an individual because it's all pervasive.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there's one conscious spiritual energy. It is an all-pervasive energy, it is conscious, it is indistinguishable. That is their conception of the ultimate reality.
Okay.
Right? And they feel, they speculate that parts of that Brahman have been covered by illusion and parts of it haven't. So, the question is, there can't be parts of Brahman. Because it's supposed to be one indistinguishable spiritual energy. That one part can't be distinguished from another part. As soon as you say parts, that means it's not one. That means you're... So, if you say parts, then either they've broken off, been cut off, been cleaved off, which is against all Vedic statements, because Brahman, the soul cannot be cut, mutated, changed in any way, which means that it leaves you one other final conclusion, which is the statement of Krishna in the Vedas, is that they must be eternally parts, and they must be tiny parts,
because the Supreme Brahman cannot be covered by Maya in the same way that the sun, sunshine, cannot be covered by a cloud. But a tiny portion, a few atomic particles of sunshine can be covered by a cloud.
Spark of fire can be extinguished.
Sparks of fire can be extinguished, but not the big fire. So, as you said, the real conclusion is what makes sense, which gives the Gita authority, which is consistent that Krishna is speaking on the spiritual platform about eternal individuality, and was consistent with all the statements of the Vedas that the soul is changeless. Right. And that the individual atomic cells can be covered by Maya, but the Supreme Brahman cannot be. That is consistent. Is that clear?
So if you are saying that soul is, that we can't burn, that it can't be kept cut, so if that statement is fine, how can we say that we are the part and parcel of God?
And these were eternally a fragment. Always been an individual. That's what Krishna said in the very beginning. Always in the past, we've been an individual. Now, and always in the future, you have been an individual, fragmental part. There's no time where at some stage, God got out his cleaver and started chopping up his spiritual energy into little bits. So, is that okay? So the fourth point where Krishna counters the Mayavadi philosophy again is that if Krishna is an illusion, then again there is no the Mayavadis, they say that the distinction between Krishna and Arjuna is illusion. The distinction between them. And that in actuality they're one Brahman. That when Krishna realizes he's the one Brahman, Arjuna is that so-called little part of Brahman who is covered. But as we understand, that is not possible. But the Mayavadis, they hold that they are one. And the difference between them is only illusion. There's no difference between Arjuna and Krishna. They are both the one undifferentiated, all-pervasive Brahman spiritual energy. Really, no, there are no two individuals. Brahman individuals.
I think what Nikshara Prabhupada says is, at the end of Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna says that I'm free from illusion.
Yes.
That doesn't mean he becomes Krishna.
What's that?
That doesn't mean at the end of the Bhagavad Gita,
that's
Arjuna
right.
becomes Krishna.
So when, that's a good point. And when Krishna, when Arjuna becomes liberated by knowledge, he doesn't become, Krishna. He still remains Arjuna with Krishna. And the other point also is that if the distinction between them is illusion, then there's no need for one to take the position of the instructor and the other one as the instructed, in which case it defeats the whole purpose of going to Krishna's Bhagavad Gita for instruction. Again, similar to the first point.
And nor is there any need of asking Arjuna to fight, because whether he fights or he doesn't fight, the result will be the same.
That's right. Yes. all activities ultimately lead to the one, you know, the, any distinction in activities and any distinction in the results is all as well. That's what they say. In which case, if everything is illusion, there is no need for an instructor, there is no need for instruction, then why are they speaking? Why are the Mayavadis teaching Mayavad philosophy? Because there's no need for an instructor, because the instructor, the instructed, why are they teaching? Krishna is teaching because he knows that actually there is a need for an instructor, because the Supreme Brahman is not covered by illusion, and the Supreme Brahman liberates the individual souls who are covered by illusion. Therefore, there is a need for an instructor and an instructed. But for the Mayavadis, that all becomes a meaningless, illusory dream. Why are they giving instruction? Why are they writing books? Okay. So, ultimately, their conclusion is that we should not listen to them if they are correct, and if they are wrong, we should listen to Krishna.
What is the aim of Mayavadis? What do they want, actually?
The Mayavadis want to transcend the material world and attain the spiritual platform. It's just that their understanding of the spiritual platform has been conceived from a material perspective. It is not confirmed by Shastra. It is not confirmed by, you know, Guru, Sadhu, Krishna. But they want spiritual perfection, but their conception of spiritual perfection has been conceived on a material platform, from a material position. So therefore, these are four arguments whereby Srila Prabhupada, on the basis of the Bhagavad Gita, the Vedic literatures, completely counters any argument that the Mayavadis could pose, and those same arguments are really, you'll see glimpses of each of those in each of the verses that follow verse 12 up to verse 20, 30, where it's discussing the nature of the soul. So therefore, Krishna's conclusion to Arjuna is that the material body is destructible and sure to come to an end, but the individual soul you cannot kill. Therefore, if you're compassionate, Arjuna, to these individual people, actually you cannot kill them. You will not be killing them. So if that is causing you, you know, lamentation and grief, don't worry about that, because you actually cannot kill, harm, mutate, change the eternal individual soul at all. But just as a surgeon may perform an operation and cut with a knife for the ultimate benefit of the patient, so the surgeon does his duty, even though he may inflict a little bit of pain, but what he's trying to do is to work for the ultimate good of the patient. And Krishna is saying, in the same mood, in the same way that a justice of the peace, will inflict some punishment, but for the ultimate welfare of the individual and society at large, he performs his duty in exactly the same mood. Arjuna, you are a Kshatriya meant to give protection spiritually and materially to the people of the world. You perform your duty, but don't think that you're snuffing out of existence, these individuals.
certainly there is some temporary inconvenience, but for the greater benefit of everyone, and your compassion should be directed towards the soul, which is actually the person. It is their eternal situation, rather than the material body, which you can't save no matter what you do anyway, Arjuna. Even if you don't perform your duty, still their bodies are going to come to destruction. So you have to work on the spiritual platform to get any real result. So,
what is my wish? What is the reason you are giving for Arjuna to fight? Because either way, it is illusion.
Yeah, the Mayavadis, they give up activity. They feel that now I have realized that I'm a spirit soul, and all activities in the material world are illusion, even those mentioned in the Vedas, therefore I cease activities. So they cease activities.
What is the reason they give for Arjuna fighting?
Well, they think he shouldn't, ultimately, that he shouldn't fight. They think ultimately all duties, including Arjuna, should be given up. All duties. What to speak of Arjuna? Because they're all based on illusion. But that's why Krishna keeps saying, and we see that throughout the Gita, that Krishna, every time Krishna gives some information about the spirit soul and the soul's spiritual platform in any way, quite often just after that he will say, therefore fight.
Right.
In other words, he keeps saying, just because I'm telling you you're spiritual does not mean, oh, I'm a spirit soul, I have nothing to do with this material world, therefore I should give up all activity. So he keeps telling him, because you're spiritual, I'm telling you you're spiritual, but I'm not telling you to give up activities. He doesn't say that. In fact, he says that, as we understand, that the soul is described as very amazing. And it is amazing for three different reasons. One is because the spirit soul, it can inhabit, it can be in the body of a tiny little, germ, or it can be in the body of a huge banyan tree which can stretch for a mile. Big elephants, Timangilla fish. So that's the nature of the soul. It's amazing. At the same time, the soul is considered amazing because it's so amazing, those qualities, that becomes inconceivable for people who are absorbed in sense gratification and just absorbed in material life, enjoying the senses, enjoying the body, on that platform where there's no sacrifice, no austerity, they cannot understand the soul because they're completely absorbed in the body. The third reason it's considered amazing is because the soul, in all respects, can actually be confused as being non-different from Vishnu or the all-pervading super soul. Right? So, because the soul is so amazing like that, and therefore very, very hard to understand, Krishna keeps recommending, if you're not on the spiritual platform, perform your duties, because that will bring you to the spiritual platform. That will purify your existence. So Krishna keeps saying, if you're not on the spiritual platform, perform your duty, and that will keep bringing you to a purified stage of existence. Gradually it gets you off the material platform of thinking in terms of the body. When we think in terms of the body, we think in terms of happiness and distress, loss and gain, victory and defeat. That's thinking in terms of the body. When we do our duty, we actually have to get off that platform to perform our duty. So he keeps saying, perform your duty, because that gets you off that platform. You get into the habit of doing your duty and stop thinking about happiness and distress like that. So that purifies you. So Krishna keeps telling him, you must do your duty. And when you get onto the spiritual platform, that is what we're leading into in the next class that we have, where Krishna explains that do your duty, you know, fight Arjuna for me. The relationship between God and the living entity, when material activities stop, then loving, devotional, spiritual activities begin, and therefore Krishna still says, fight on those spiritual grounds. But the Mayavadis, they say, give up. But Krishna never says that. He says, it's the very nature of the spirit soul to be active.
Just a question. Again, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that one must perform one's own duty even if it's performed imperfectly.
Yeah.
But Krishna is there talking about Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, the Varnashram system. But it's not existent in that is.
What's that?
It's not existent in that is. In other words, we're all.
Yes, it is. We have the intellectuals in this room.
But not performing. Not performing. That duty is not.
It may be a little bit greater, but the system is still there. It's natural. Even in animal society. Even you look at a colony of ants, you see that someone is organizing, some are working, like that. And the system is always there, whether it's in its perfect form or a degraded form, as it may be now, but it is there because it's natural. There's always a class of intellectuals, there's always a class of those who organize and may enforce that, the rules and regulations. There are always those who produce for the society, and there are those who are engaged by those three, in the various tasks that are needed, the workers.
But suppose in the commerce work field, I suppose that would be synonymous with the Vaishya. I wouldn't be protecting cows or tilling land. Rather, I'll be managing some people or managing some work, which is kind of the administrative role.
Mm.
At the same time, I'll be earning money and selling stuff, which is the duty of a Vaishya. So, what is precisely my duty there? Just to earn something and go with Krishna consciousness?
That is. We have the standard, right? Of Krishna gives the standard of what a Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya and Sudra should be doing. In this age, everything is a bit topsy-turvy. We head in that direction and do the best we can.
So what do I do?
That will come up later when we actually discuss that in the 18th chapter.
Okay.
But basically, you're heading that direction.
So, if my body says that we should cease activity, then it means that the instruction of Bhagavad Gita is false to them. They don't follow Bhagavad Gita or Krishna. And everything that's spoken in Bhagavad Gita is false.
Yes, the philosophy doesn't stand up on many grounds. As soon as they start making statements like that, everything in the material world, including the so-called instructions from God, the Vedic injunctions, the conception of the distinction between God and the living entity, as soon as they say that all these things are an illusion. It means that the words coming out of their mouth are also a delusion, and therefore, why would you want to listen to them, including themselves? It just makes no sense at all. It's childish. We can sit here and have a very deep philosophical conversation. When you get down to it, it's actually quite childish. You know, everything in this room is one. I am you. You are me. I just, you know. It is, it's ridiculous, it's laughable, it's ridiculous. It just doesn't hold up. You know, even a child really can understand that, you know, most of their statements are ridiculous. That means our mothers, when we're children, just, you know, instead of feeding us, just say, grab a bit of dirt, it's all right. Why are you asking for, you know, a cheese sandwich? It is one with the dirt.
Why make hospitals?
Why in the bath, have a drink. Eat the soap. You know. Why wash? You're one with the soap. You're one with the teacher, why bother going there? And stay home and watch TV. But, you know, if everything is one, why are they, you know, begging? Why are they asking charity? You know, they should be already one with that money that they want. Why are they in need? The other charity. So, you know, it doesn't hold up. It's, you know, on materially, spiritually, logically, it's quite childish. But, you know, people are very bewildered.
Actually, from what you're saying, then it's very easy for them to fall into maya. Like, if somebody is not very strong, they can very easily take the material activities.
If someone is not very strong, well, in Mayavadi, in their own philosophy.
Yeah, it's very dangerous because they can take to material activities very easily.
They've actually, Prabhupada mentions that a few times, that they've actually done a huge disservice to the world because they have painted this picture of the spiritual world. There's no variety, there's no fun, there's no activities, there's no love. It is just existence. Now, who is attracted? Who, you know, put your hands up. Who wants to go there? You know, you imagine a tourist agency. You know, you sell tickets. We're going to put you on a plane, and when you go to this place, you know, there'll be nothing to do. There'll be nothing to eat. There'll be no one there. Not even you. You'll just be fooling yourself that you're there. There'll be nothing to look at. How many tickets do you think they sell? So, you know, that's why, you know, it's because of philosophies like that. So people, you know, they give up on spiritual life and they think, oh, I think I'll stay here in the material world. Get what I can, what I can. Yeah. So, Arjuna is. So, Krishna, you know, explaining that point that although I'm telling that you're spiritual, I am not saying, nor does he say throughout the course of the Bhagavad Gita, therefore, Arjuna, don't do anything. You're a spirit soul, therefore stop, you know, all activity in this material world. He doesn't say that. He says, you're spiritual, so fight. Because all Krishna has done here is defeated his misdirected compassion. That, you know, you are, Arjuna is thinking, oh, how can I kill these people? So that's his compassion. And Krishna said, well, you're not going to kill them. They're eternally individual souls. So all he's done is defeated that and therefore explained many spiritual concepts to do that. And to further, you know, counteract Arjuna's argument, the same argument, He also introduces other philosophies to counteract him, you know, say, you know, if you have any other, just, you know, in case of thinking, you know, the Mayavadi we have defeated, especially in that verse 23, I think it's verse 26, that Krishna then discusses about the spirit soul, and about the Vaiva seekers who, you know, bought at Vada. They believe that there is no spirit soul. So if someone, if Arjuna wanted to argue on that platform, oh, maybe there isn't a spirit soul. Maybe you defeated the Mayavadi. What about today? They say there is no Brahman at all. There's no soul. There's no spirit. So then Arjuna, if there's no spirit, how can there be sin? What are you killing? You know, you're not killing a spirit soul. If there was a spirit soul, you couldn't kill it. And if there's no soul, again, you know, where's the question of killing? If there's no soul, there's no, you know, eternal life principle. So, in that way, again, you know, Krishna is saying that, you know, there can be no question of killing if you accept that philosophy. If Arjuna proposes the philosophy of the Karmavadas, those who, they basically propound that, okay, you know, this material world is the ultimate reality, and if you want to live in this world and be happy, you perform your duty, you get good karmic reaction, that gives you a good body to perform your duty nicely. By performing your duty nicely, you can go to the heavenly planets. If you happen to come down again, perform your duty, get another good body like this, and you just, so keep doing your duty. That is, you know, this material world is a reality, and doing your duty is the prime thing which actually allows you to enjoy. And if you don't do your duty, it is sinful, and you'll get a bad reaction. Not doing your duty means you're doing something which invokes some bad reaction. So even if we accept that, just from the materialistic point of view of this world is the all in all, and we do good work to get a good result, then do your duty. You know, all those duties. So there are some who, you know, even who follow the Vedas, but they don't have a full understanding of the Vedas. They have that understanding that all the duties are set out in the Vedas. If you do them, you'll enjoy good results in the material world. So even from that platform, again, not taking anything spiritual, whether Mayavad or Buddhist, into consideration, still do your duty. If Arjuna accepts the position of the voidists, who say that, you know, there is a state of void, so Krishna counters that by saying that actually there is a manifest state of being, of existence, and there certainly is an unmanifest state. But even in the unmanifest state, still there's no loss of energy. Everything, matter is conserved. This is one of the understandings also of the physicists, right? The law of conservation of energy. So that, you know, if you break down that chair into the atoms, nothing is lost. Those atoms, the energy, they go into the environment and they just take shape somewhere else. And in that, you know, in that argument, everything really, either it's energy, chemicals manifest either as a chair, and then the same chemicals are not manifest as a chair, they end up, you know, in some other objects. But who laments the loss of so many chemicals? You know, if you throw some salt into the wind, it blows away. You don't get the RSPC
PCA, you know, banging on your door. Oh, what have you done with, you know, cruelty to that handful of salts? You know, you don't get the law coming down upon you. 20 years. Because no one laments. You know, if there is some life involved, then there's reason for consideration. But, you know, for chemicals, manifest or unmanifested, we're still just talking about chemicals. So on various different arguments, Krishna actually defeats Arjuna and brings him to this understanding. Therefore, you are an eternal individual spirit soul. You also have a duty in this world as a kshatriya. They are eternal individual spirit souls who have neglected their duty. You should perform your duty and correct the situation, correct their mentality for everyone's ultimate good. And if you do that, on all these different considerations, there is no question of sin. And it is the ultimate compassionate thing to do. And there is no real incompassion because you're not killing anyone, really. But you are creating a better situation all around. So, which brings us to today's topic. So, perhaps we can take a break for 5 minutes, get a bit of fresh air, there's a lot to absorb, and we'll come back if you want to stretch your legs and what have you, and then we'll just cover today's. Did you want to?
Whatever we have discussed, Krishna is trying to defeat Arjuna's argument for compassion, right?
Yes, up until about verse 30, and then from verse 31 to 38, Krishna, you know, in a sense, is continuing to defeat that argument of compassion, but very much there's a strong argument to defeat Arjuna's fear of not being able to enjoy. And furthermore, you know, he concludes that therefore, that, you know, there can be no sin. So really, at this point, you know, all of this has been convincing Arjuna that not fighting on grounds of compassion is unfounded, you know, on any philosophical level you look at. And to do that, he's had to make Arjuna look at the spiritual, eternal individual spiritual nature of the soul. And when you see that, you understand, oh yes, okay, there may be the temporary change of dress or what have you, but I'm not killing anyone like that. And then gradually, as we get into the next section, we see that that is also therefore not sinful. Not only is it not sinful, but it also, either way Arjuna looks at it, it will actually bring him to a position where he can enjoy the results of his activities. Yeah. Alright, so we'll just take a break for a couple of minutes and then we'll...
Alright.
So, now in verses 31 to 38, Krishna is saying to Arjuna, after explaining, defeating Arjuna's arguments on the basis of the eternality of the soul, the individual soul, Krishna is now saying, even if you're thinking in terms of the body, still your argument is defeated. That is the essence of 31 to 38. And to do this, Krishna takes the position of those who follow the, that place importance on the Karma Kanda section of the Vedas. You know, duty for duty's sake,
not really taking much conception of duty in relationship to executed for the Supreme Lord, which is more Karma Yoga. Karma Kanda is duty for duty's sake without that real relationship with the Supreme Lord. So and in verse 32 you see that and the argument of Arjuna's, or the fear of Arjuna's, caused his hesitancy to fight. One of them was enjoyment, and by Krishna, of course, if we're speaking about enjoyment, Arjuna speaking on a bodily platform, and therefore Krishna was saying, okay, let's discuss things on that platform of enjoyment, on the bodily platform of enjoyment. Your argument doesn't even stand ground there, Arjuna, because, you know, if you do win, as he just describes, in verse 32, Krishna describes the result if Arjuna does this duty. He says, O Partha, happy are the Kshatriyas to whom such fighting opportunities come unsought, opening for them the doors of the heavenly planets. So, if Arjuna fights, performs his duty, then he will ultimately attain the heavenly planets, which is a platform of enjoyment. And that is something that is very clear to personalities like Arjuna. The next verses describe what happens if he doesn't perform his duty, and then it describes that in that case he is guilty of negligence of duty, and that incurs a sinful reaction, which means he will then suffer. So in other words, if he doesn't perform his duty, he will incur sin and suffer. And apart from the suffering as a result of sinful reaction and loss of the opportunity to attain the heavenly planets, even in this lifetime he will also be vilified and defamed, which for a Kshatriya such as Arjuna is a suffering that is worse than death. You know, for one who has been greatly honoured, then to be vilified like that, very, very cause of great suffering. So in that way, Krishna is pointing out that if you perform your duty, actually you will enjoy it. And if you don't perform your duty, then you'll suffer. There will also be the suffering of infamy, and the sinful reaction which you're hoping to avoid, you will actually be getting sinful reaction by not fighting. It's a very simple argument. Therefore, Krishna concludes this section by saying that therefore Arjuna, do you want to read the exact translation? Text number 38.
Do thou fight for the sake of fighting, without considering happiness or distress, loss or gain, victory or defeat, and by doing so you shall never incur sin.
Yep. So, again, because Arjuna is speaking from this platform of whether I'll be happy or distress. So, where does that derive from? Victory or defeat? If Arjuna, he is thinking, if I get victory, then there will be gain and there will be happiness. If there is defeat, then there will be loss and distress.
Alright? But ultimately he is thinking in terms of his happiness and distress. And Krishna is saying, if you're thinking in terms of your happiness and distress, you're better off to fight. But Krishna is also pointing out his there is a hint that he should perform his activities in Krishna consciousness for a higher cause, and in that sense performing his activities for the sake of the soul, or on a higher level for the sake of the Supreme Soul, in that sense he also shouldn't consider, you know, the dualities of victory and defeat, because then he's doing it on behalf of the Lord. So that verse is sort of gradually bringing us into the next topic, where Krishna begins to discuss acting on behalf of the Lord in Buddha Yoga. There's a hint of that there. But on all previous arguments, the conclusion is better to perform your duty. And that duty should be performed in such a way that it elevates you above the bodily conception of life of these dualities. That is the result that you want. So is there any further comments or questions?
Could you just tell us when Sri Krishna says Shrimad Bhagavatam, Mam Maya Duratya, what does it mean?
Mamamaya Dracha, yeah, that this material energy cannot be overcome, that verse, is that right?
Yes.
it means that the living entity cannot transcend or rise above or get out of the clutches of illusion by his own individual efforts.
So illusion is there.
Yes. Only by the surrendering to the Supreme Brahman, who is never touched by illusion, can one actually get out of the clutches of that illusion or mind. Yeah. But does that make it clearer or more confusing? Does everyone feel a bit more clear on that now? Yeah? Yeah. Okay.
Really good. One question only. When Arjuna puts forth the reason that if I kill my seniors and elders and teachers, I go to hellish planets.
Yes.
Doesn't it state that he is aware of the transmigration of soul even before Krishna states that in the second chapter? He says that I'll be going to hellish planets.
That's right.
Central reaction. He is aware, completely aware of the fact that.
That's right.
Yes. Soul migrates. But why should Krishna say it again in the second chapter, 13 verse?
Well, there is transmigration, but, you know, transmigration of from Arjuna going to either the heavenly planets or the hellish planets still doesn't answer the question as to whether you know, he is an eternal individual soul going to the higher planets or the hellish planets, or whether the a part of the Supreme Brahman is in that illusion. It doesn't answer that question. Or whether it doesn't even answer the question whether there is a soul. You know, the Buddhists, they they understand that, you know, the soul takes different births, upper, higher, lower, different planets, but they can see that that's all happening without the presence of a soul or a super soul. So that conception may be there, but it doesn't confirm the eternal individuality or deny the eternal individuality of the soul. So therefore Krishna explained that. For instance, someone might think, I perform this activity in this life, I go to the heavenly planets, I enjoy there, and then while I'm there, I become self-realized and become void. Or what, you know, or at some stage, you know, after the suffering or the heavenly rewards, I realize that I am Brahman emerging to the, you know, lose my eternal identity. As we explained, some people would actually prefer to go to the heavenly planets than to merge into Brahman. You know, that is more attractive. So, you know, those things can be there, going to heaven, going to hell, but it doesn't take into consideration the eternal individual spirit souls.
So with that reason, you were able to come back and fight. After he understood the fact that he is an eternally existing individual soul.
Yes, because that made him understand that he wasn't actually killing these individuals. So for instance, the Buddhist might conceive that, you know, because there's no soul, you may die here in this world, and then appear as a different individual in the heavenly planets. But because there's no soul, there's not necessarily the same person. So then there is no eternal, same individual soul. You know, you can, for instance, there's just living entities taking individual, you know, taking temporary individual consciousnesses.
I don't understand how that's viable.
That's right.
And who's the authority who gives them the reaction?
That's right. You know, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and then the Acharyas elucidate on 9 principal faults within the Buddhist philosophy.
Which verse is that?
It's in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, in the section where Lord Chaitanya actually talks to the Buddhist. I'm not sure exactly. When he's travelling through South India, which is Majinuda.
Chapter?
I'm not sure. Okay. But it mentions there the 9 different faults in the Buddhist philosophy. But because it doesn't really make sense, therefore even the Buddhists have many different conceptions of what Buddhism is. Vedic philosophy is consistent because it's a reality. Reality is easy to make consistent. If you created a philosophy that is not consistent with reality, then you know you have a lot of trouble maintaining consistency, and therefore even amongst Buddhists, impersonalists, Mayavadis, they have different arguments to each other. You know. So, like, therefore, you know, we're presenting some of their main arguments, some of the main arguments against the Buddhists, but we can't go into all the different arguments. There are 9, you know, principal faults which we can certainly understand and defeat, but we can't go into all their arguments because they don't even know all the arguments. their philosophy is very inconsistent, because there is no consistent conception of reality. Vedic philosophy is consistent because it's consistent with reality. So therefore, you know what Prahlad Maharaj said millions of years ago, you know, Lord Chaitanya says 500 years ago. If you look in the Srimad Bhagavatam, you know, and even you look at the Acharyas, you know, through hundreds of years, thousands of years, millions of years, what Lord Rama is saying millions of years ago, what Krishna is saying, it is completely consistent, because it is consistent with reality. As soon as you lose consistency with reality, then you cannot have a consistent philosophy, and therefore they argue amongst each other. And therefore, if they don't know their own philosophy, how are we to understand their own philosophy? Quite often, when I speak to people about, they ask me some question about Krishna consciousness in comparison to their own philosophy, quite often I first have to teach them their philosophy in order for me to then present, you know, some discussion, because they don't even know it. You talk to Buddhists these days, you know, Christians, you have to remind the Christian, oh, actually, isn't this your philosophy? And all of them, you have, you know, they're just so mixed up, especially now, but even previously, and their scriptures. So just stick to the main arguments, and that's enough to defeat all the other, you know, bits and pieces. All right, everyone knows the questions for and homework for next week. I'll just read them out again, just in case anyone didn't get them on the net. Lesson 5, chapter 2, read verses 39 to 49, and answer the workbook questions in section E, where relevant. Generic question number 13 and the context question number 2. So if I forgot to ask you one question. One thing, if you see people who, you know, should have been filling these empty chairs, you might want to tell them to listen to this class, because it really summed up, you know, everything we've been doing in the last 3 weeks. Tri Yuga wants to know if there's any possibility we can do the Thursday evening class on a Wednesday evening, because there are, for instance, like tonight, a lot of the urban yoga things will happen on Thursday night, and therefore there can be a clash, as we see. So, hands up those who Wednesday night's out of the question.
Bhakti
Vriksha
program happening here.
Bhakti Vriksha? Okay.
Jagannatharam Prabhu is taking class.
Who's that?
Jagannatharam.
Jagannatharam.
It's been going on for a year.
Anyone else? Wednesday is okay? What is it? Wednesday is out?
Okay.
Yeah, possibly. My husband.
Okay.
Late Wednesday.
Right, okay. Mm.
I would have to wait for many hours after university finished.
Okay. Alright. For those two or three who may have some difficulty, can you have a think about that and get back to me next time, and just we'll leave it open for further discussion. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.